the welfare of the United States. So they started the Soil Conservation Service. We look at the way that this myth was kind of enhancing American agriculture was, if you look on the state seals of most of the states in the United States, 50 states, there's 10 of those that have the word plow on the state seal. Beginning to really think that the symbol of agriculture was the plow. I'm here to say that we found out now through soil conservation practices that is probably a devastating event that happened in the 30s that really has led to the National Resource Conservation Service now, which is the NRCS, and the importance of why we should look at no-tilling and cover cropping and keeping a living plant on the surface of the soil. And today I would say that there's probably 25% of American agriculture land is now no-till farming. And we really can begin to see that these practices that we're beginning to implement with understanding tillage and limited tillage is really beginning to change the landscape of what's been going on in the American agriculture. Another myth is that fertilizer inputs are necessary very often for crop performance. Next slide. The amount of soil samples pulled in North America are about 10 million per year. And with that, turn to the next slide, Jamie. What we're finding, look, one more back. There we go. So there's over 10 million soil samples that are gathered each year that do one thing. And these recommendations from that particular section of agriculture are designed to sell fertility. And if you look at the amount of fertilizer supplied on American cropland, it's probably around $4 billion a year. I think it is. I lost my slide somewhere.
Or there might be a lag out. Are you wanting the biological soil solutions or the adoption of data?
No, that one there. That's the slide I want to be on.
Okay.
So these recommendations have been going on for over 70 years. And when we came out with methods to look at fertility management, the common extractions used in the laboratory were first developed in the 1940s and 50s, came out in the 1990s with the Mayley 3 extraction, and then now we're looking at more robust models to look at soil health by looking at respiration. Rick Haney developed the Haney test in the late 90s, which is now part of the solution to where we can look at respiration and begin to kind of give an overview of what the soil is actually doing. But this myth that higher levels of fertility will actually grow better crops is really not true. We know that I said $4 billion, it's almost $9 billion a year is spent on NPK fertilizer inputs. And I think we're beginning to realize now that actually soil is no different than the soil interaction between the plant and the soil is no different than the human gut, and that it's a digestive system, and that we can better absorb nutrients. The plant can better absorb nutrients in a healthy condition where they have a really robust microbial colony in that environment. The analogy highlights soil critical function and recycling nutrients for plant and ecosystem health. What we're beginning to see in soil science is that we've kind of went down a path that's almost completely depleted the ability for the plant to absorb nutrients because we've so damaged the soil front, the functionality. So at BTI, we developed a method, a testing method we call the soil functionality analysis. Next slide, Jamie. And in that, I want to take a comprehensive look at the way soils actually are functioning, not just with fertility inputs, but with also looking at the microbial colonies that are in the soil. And so we developed a report where we can actually look at three different individual and I would say analytical data sets to we look at total nutrients, and if you look at that top one there, the majority of the time when I see total nutrients in the soil sample, this is a 0 to 8 inch sample, I'll see these numbers in the thousands of pounds per acre. We don't have deficiencies in fertility. We have issues with the plant's ability to pick those nutrients up. And so we look at this through a lens of total nutrients, available nutrients, and then what is blocking that nutrient pickup. And it's traditionally what we call a compromised biological input. So what I can do now we can give prescriptions. We can actually go in and say, you don't need higher levels of fertilizer to raise 230 bushels of corn. You actually need a much less amount, but a higher functionality. So this is the benefit of what we're beginning to see. We're debunking this myth that fertility grows higher yields, when we really know that limited fertility with higher concentrations of soil functionality will actually grow better crop. Next slide. Another misconception is organic versus conventional farming. We know that there's a lot out there that says, well, organic farming is really difficult to do, and it really is, because what we're seeing is that the ineffective organic herbicides that are out there, we don't have good plant protection materials and products that can help with not using synthetics or non-approved organic products. We end up having to do more and more tillage in these operations, and that leads to compaction and stresses to the plant. And so the idea that if we're going to move away from conventional farming and have a more healthy, robust food supply, maybe we ought to go to organic farming. And we're finding out that that's kind of a misconception, that we need to think more about a regenerative model and a more sustainable model. And so we need to understand, and I think I've begun to find that true in agriculture with my work, that we need to understand both systems, the pros and cons of both, and be able to align that with a more comprehensive view of how do we farm with less devastation on the soils. Next slide. So we have a lot of misconceptions in agriculture, and that's kind of what my career has led me down the path to do, to really kind of see where have we failed as agronomists in making recommendations to farmers, and what can we do to better implement better practices that can help, I would say, long-term sustainability. And next slide. And so what we want to do is just really do a look at what the environmental impacts are in agriculture. You know, the ideas out there that agriculture affects the environments through land use, water consumption, emissions impacting ecosystems, and we see that there are states like the state of Iowa that are going through massive changes in the amount of nitrogen they apply on the farmland. We're noticing now that some of the land grant colleges are beginning to look at implementing practices for soil health. How can we look at soil biology, not just fertility management, not just input applications of different molecules that can help control herbicides? We know that the side effects of excessive use of glyphosate, other herbicides are causing, certain detrimental effects to the plant, to the soil. And we want to be able to kind of see that maybe these common myths are often overstated in agriculture, and their negative impacts have really caused some devastation in some of our farm grounds. Implementation of more sustainable farming practices is kind of the way that I think the industry is beginning to go. And understanding that a balanced view of agriculture and environmental impacts is essential to inform policymakers and how we can better effectively and manage our environment. So 90% of my job now is importance of education and community outreach. Today I'm at the Soil Health Coalition event in Redwood, Minnesota, where we're visiting farms and beginning to talk to farmers about implementing more sustainable practices, and showing that using conventional farming is probably more costly, and because of commodity prices, they're beginning to see that, you know, it's just cost, it's not cost effective to farm the way we've been taught in the past through our education system. And I'm guilty of that. I came out of ag retail and, you know, throwing fertility and stress management, I would call them plant protection products toward the plant, aren't the solution. We got to be able to figure out how we can prevent problems, better understanding of that, the way soils function, and a better comprehensive idea of what we can do to improve it. So outreach programs, being involved in community projects like this one here, like we're doing with this webinar today, are essential for us to begin to start changing some of these myths and begin to start figuring out what can we do to improve our farming practices. So there's going to always be enduring myths in agriculture. We're going down the path now that we're the larger ag retail community is beginning to really embrace biologicals, biological inputs. These products need to be verified and tested, and we need to get more ideas. It's the Wild West out there when you look at what's happening in ag. I don't believe we should trend away from our practices from what we used to do, but we need to be more embracing and look at and accommodating to new ideas and new concepts. So I'm going to not say that we should not use fertility. I'm not that type of guy. I'm going to say that if we do it, let's use it smart, which means we need to do more education. We need to do more soil testing, more tissue testing, and understand what's actually happening in the soil and how plants function and how they adapt to their environments. I would say the American farmer today is more of a stress manager than they are a farmer. Anyway, that's the end of my presentation. So thank you all.
Very nice.
Excellent. Thanks, Al. And now we've got David Knaus for this next presentation. Be sure to answer your questions. I see a couple questions coming through, so we'll definitely get to those afterwards. David, are you here? I see your camera's off.
Excellent. Yeah, I'm here.
Okay. Well, I'm going to grant you permission to share your screen. Give me one second. All right.
Okay.
Looks good.
All right. Everyone can see that?
Yes.
All right. Thank you, everyone. Thank you, Jamie. Appreciate everyone's here today. Again, my name is David Knaus. I'm the president and founder of Apical Crop Science. We're a lab-based agronomy firm in Oregon. And for the last 10 years, we've been studying plant sap analysis in a variety of forms, and using that to drive agronomic solutions for growers around the country and beyond. Our analysis is strong enough that we are able to use that same process to drive product selection, consulting, organic transitions in multitude of different growers. So I was asked by Jamie and Al to do some myth busting today for you guys, and since it's been a bit of my job as throughout my career of breaking up some of the wrong assumptions or poking holes in insufficiently developed arguments, I figured this was a great opportunity. So without further ado, let's get into it. So as you might know, I'm a certified crop advisor. I apply the 4R nutrient principles daily. At Apical, we don't guess. Excuse me. Our approach balances practicality, economics, and environmental ethics, and we encourage responsible experimentation, all of this guided by data. We assume no responsibility for the misuse or application of these concepts, so use this at your own risk under the supervision of your agronomist. So for a lot of the data that you'll see today, we are generating this with our leaf sap analysis. And if you're not familiar with leaf sap analysis technology, I'd encourage you to look into it. There's a number of labs, maybe 10 or 12, doing it globally. We came across this technology through some international partners about 10 years ago. And we found that it was an extremely powerful tool and could help us to identify a lot of things that were happening within the plant, subtle nutrient combinations and so forth. What you're looking at here is before and after pictures of plant nutrient extraction. So in other words, we extract the fluid from the leaves, leave the leaves intact, and then analyze the fluids. So the first myth that we discovered, and this was actually one of the myths that I discovered that led me to starting the lab initially, and that was that nutrient mobility is adequately explained by the Mulder's chart and visual observation. So in the picture itself, you can see that there's, in fact, a number of different elements missing, such as sodium, sulfur, chlorine, aluminum, etc., when the chart was created. Now, I don't know if that was the original intent of the chart itself. However, the fact of the matter was is that I found myself as an agronomist lacking in nutrient management skills by using these two tools. I would go out to the field, look at visual observation, and make mistakes. And so I learned along the way that silicon, iodine, cobalt had since been identified as beneficial nutrients. This leads to a really confusing situation for most agronomists out there. And this was something that we felt very strongly at Apical needed to be unpacked and analyzed a bit further if we were going to actually get what we wanted out of crop advising, nutrient management, nutrient applications, and so forth. Second myth that we commonly hear, nutrient deficiency are the main limiting factor solved by nutrient management. And by nutrient management, I mean analysis into applications. So analysis, product selection, applications. So in truth, there's often a lot of stress that's created by salt excesses, metals excesses, or nutrient antagonism. And through our research, we found that all of these are significantly more impactful in terms of nutrient management than actual nutrient deficiencies. So echoing some of the previous statements that Al mentioned a minute ago about figuring out that it wasn't necessarily nutrient level increases that increased, you know, in the soil that increased levels in the plant, we see this also, but from a slightly different perspective. We see antagonism, excesses, imbalances within the soil nutrient profile, limiting the crop and translating into improper results in the field. So here's a really good example of that in an alfalfa block that we analyzed out of Texas. And you can see I don't know if you can see my cursor here, but we've got very, very strong sodium spike, very, very strong chloride spike, and a whole host of micronutrient imbalances within the plant. Now, this is one example of our plant sap analysis technology reports. And you can see that we analyze both the new leaves as well as the old leaves simultaneously and compare those two results in order to get the proper balance from new to old leaf, which is technically, if you read all the agronomy textbooks, this is what should be happening. Well, we don't really have a way to identify all of these nutrient combinations unless we're actually analyzing them in the leaf. And I know very few leaf analysis, you know, tissue analysis labs out there that are doing simultaneously new leaf and old leaf. So if you look at the plant nutrient translocation principles, magnesium, nitrogen, phosphorus all will pull from the old leaf into the new leaf and so forth. So this is what we're trying to display with our analysis here. And in this particular situation, you see magnesium deficiency, phosphorus shortage, etc. And simultaneously, that is being induced, in our opinion, by extremely high levels of sodium to the magnitude of 10x of the tolerable level for the species. And then this is what it looks like in the field. On the left-hand side, you have the malaffected. On the right-hand side, you have a reasonably fair production of alfalfa. In the middle, you have what happens on one side of the field where the crop pretty much won't grow. And then you have on the other side of the field, the field break, where you see the difference between the salt stressed area and the non-salt stressed area. Second myth, aluminum is only available at low pH. So while this is somewhat correct of a myth out there, and it does hold true in certain elements of chemistry, when you actually get into soil science, it starts to fall apart. And we found this very early on in our research of leaf sap analysis is that we were seeing all kinds of aluminum in plants. And oftentimes those plants were in soils of 7, 8, or 9 pH, or 6.5, or 5 even, all kinds of pHs. And so we did some digging in through academic research and so forth. And number one, we found that that aluminum can be uptaken at soil pH above 8, but it can also be taken up due to soluble aluminum content in crop inputs, temporary pH drops due to acidic fertilizers or acidic soil acidification, root damage due to oxidative stress, and is also extremely frequently found in the leaf sap of crops with root disease. So in that in those types of situations, we found that it was not necessarily root disease or aluminum that were inducing the problems, but oftentimes it was the stress that the plant was under from an oxidative perspective that was inducing both the root disease as well as the aluminum uptake. Next myth, soil depletion is not a concern if we can just apply more cheap fertilizer. So here I present to you a really strong example of Florida juice citrus. So as some of you may have heard of, the Florida juice citrus is in a very bad way, that whole industry. And this is a very common example test that we see from growers in Florida. Extremely high copper levels, trying to deal with disease, and they apply tons and tons of fertilizer, lots and lots of pesticides, and then you're left with a whole host of other micronutrient imbalances, deficiencies, and essentially crops that won't produce economically anymore, and realistically an entire bioregion and farmers that have been put out of work through excessive application, poor understanding of nutrient imbalances, and lack of resources to identify those imbalances and correct them. And so we've seen in citrus, and I'll show you a few examples later, where growers have actually been able to reverse some of this decline using nutrient management and analysis, biological principles, regenerative techniques, and so forth. Next myth, micronutrient to micronutrient ratios are of little importance in crop production, and that the most importance is placed on macronutrient to macronutrient ratios, such as NPK. So we find that this is a very common misunderstanding, and that a lot of times growers are mostly focused on NPK ratios, which certainly do have their place. However, when you have micronutrient ratios such as manganese to zinc or from iron to copper or from manganese to boron, some of these ratios actually express themselves in plant growth as diminished growth factors, as poor as poor development and fruiting potential, as weak growth, as all kinds of other, you know, weak vegetative growth, as excessive excessive fruiting potential, and so forth. All of these imbalances show up later in the cropping cycle, but they first show up on the analysis. And so here's a couple examples of that. So here's an example of a where a grower says these almonds just look quote unquote bad, and then these ones look good. So when we analyze the two tests and the two different blocks, what we see is that the sodium in the on the right-hand column on the bad block is essentially 40 or 50 times the amount of what it is in the good test. Similarly, the chlorine is 4 to 5x what it was in the bad block as it is in the good block. And last but not least, here we are again, the aluminum shows up, and this is actually in a somewhat of a lower pH system. But you've got a lower pH system that also is driving sodium stress as well. Last but not least, there's a curious combination here between, oftentimes people will say, well, you know, silicon will offset aluminum, but it's not necessarily, in our opinion, that the silicon levels, because you can see here in the bad test, the silicon levels are three, almost four times the levels in the good test. However, it's the silicon to aluminum ratio that is actually malaffecting this crop. And then here's the sort of thing that you see when that gets displayed into your crop. And so if you run the numbers here, you're talking about somewhere around a 20-25% improvement in the balancing of micronutrients, phosphorus to zinc. And this is actually a slightly different crop that was that we managed zinc to phosphorus ratios in order to improve nut production. So that can be a very powerful tool for growers. Well, if you're only looking at macronutrient to macronutrient ratios and forgetting about micronutrients, you could be limiting your crop 10, 20, 30%. And if that is the situation for a lot of growers in this country, that's everything that it means to turn a profit. Here's another one in a slightly less valuable crop, winter wheat. This is in a dry land wheat situation in the Palouse. So on the left-hand side, you see a biological system that's producing comparable yield to a conventional system. However, the biological system has nearly doubled and outperformed the phosphorus numbers of the conventional system when the conventional system was applying MAP and O50O and things like that, and the biological system was using things such as soft rock phosphate and phosphorus solubilizing microbes. Secondarily, you'll also see here again where the silicon in the bio is nearly 3, almost 4x what it was in the conventional system. Now translate that into yield production, where these two yields are very, very similar, but the micronutrient combinations are completely different. So if you're a grower, would it be cheaper to spend more money on NPK, or would it be cheaper to lower excesses and raise certain key elemental micronutrients? That's up to you. Next myth, the plant luxury levels do not affect crop production negatively. So I hear oftentimes out in the industry where growers and other farm management agronomists type talk about luxury levels. And we're all about luxury levels as well. But excessive luxury levels can significantly impact and induce antagonism within other nutrients that your plant needs to survive. And so here's a really good example of that in hops, where we had a situation where we actually had a crop failure because the grower had over-applied zinc as well as nitrogen in this particular situation. I believe it was AMS. And so if you look on this test, you hear on the treated block, you see that the zinc is 127 parts per million versus 7. Which is a much more reasonable amount for the crop. Interestingly of note, when you see up here that the pH is at 0 in this crop, it's because the sample was unable to be extracted at that time because it was so stressed. And so essentially what has happened here was that the biology and the minerals were completely out of whack in the excessive block where the luxury levels of nitrogen were applied, and it caused a crop failure. Next one, yellow or brown leaves at the bottom of the plant or leaf tip necrosis usually means low nitrogen or potassium. And this is another one of those myths that gets spread around, from old wives to home gardeners to farmers to agronomists, and they look at the bottom leaves of a plant. And they say, oh, that looks like a nitrogen deficiency. Let's go apply some more nitrogen. Well, oftentimes that we've seen when growers come in to our systems, we see that it's typically not necessarily nitrogen that's the problem. It's that there has been an overapplication of sulfur or sodium, or there may be some other nutrient imbalance. In this situation, we've got multiple nutrient imbalances here in this crop. And this is a tomato crop where they've got excessive application of molybdenum, they've got a excessive application of sulfur, and they've got a very, very high amount of sodium, and all of this is interfering with nitrogen uptake into the new growth. And simultaneously, all of that has induced phosphorus deficiencies. Next one, that we commonly hear is there isn't much difference in how crop cultivars respond to different feeding programs, i.e. all cultivars or genetic varieties of a species are assumed to require similar amounts of nutrition. Well, the reality that we see out there in the field is that any two given cultivars, it doesn't matter if it's blue corn versus red corn versus yellow corn. It doesn't matter if it's Cabernet Sauvignon versus Pinot Noir. It doesn't matter if it's a nectarine, white nectarine versus a yellow peach. A lot of times there's drastically different expressions on the same feeding program in the same soil type due to genetic differences. And so here's a really good example from Peru that we have dealt with over the last number of years for some growers down there, where we see salt-affected Ventura blueberries that have 3 years of failed production due to excessive sodium in the water that the plant cannot manage. And so you can see here, you've got 292 parts per million of sodium in the old leaf and 183 parts per million in the new leaf, and that is inducing all kinds of other nutrient imbalances within the crop and root decay. Versus a salt-tolerant variety of Pop, which has a similar level of sodium in the old leaf as Ventura. However, the sodium level in the new leaf is managed down to 66 parts per million, which is actually a reasonable number for blueberries. And you similarly see that some of the other nutrient combinations in turn have been allowed to rise or at least into manageable levels. And so this is what you see typically from a visual perspective. The previous slide where the plants typically are malperforming, stunted, chlorotic, not really growing. And then you see here in this field where the crop's growing significantly vigorously. So there's different ways that you can manage salt problems, and this is something that we do at Apical very regularly. We have a lot of tools in our toolkit because we essentially identified that salt problems were a huge problem globally, and where we work to manage those for growers. Next myth that we typically hear out there is the plants require more nitrogen nowadays because there's more CO2 in the atmosphere. Well, I could see how this would be thought that, okay, yes, you know, we want to accelerate growth because there's more CO2, carbon loss, and plants like CO2, so let's apply more nitrogen, let's encourage growth, and so on and so forth. But the reality of this situation is that carbon has a much more complex role to be played in crop management than we've typically been led to believe. And that means that plants can actually exchange and utilize organic acids in a variety of different ways, from managing soil nutrient excesses to feeding those to biology, developing symbiotic relationships, and so forth. So really, by adding carbon or adjusting the carbon to nitrogen ratios in the soil, the plant can often encourage nutrient uptake. So it's not that you might not need to apply more nitrogen. That may be the case. But you also may need to apply just more carbon in the soil, not necessarily in the atmosphere, in order to catalyze those sort of reactions from the atmosphere. And so this is a really good example, again, from Washington State, where some growers were doing some mixed cropping with peas and in strip cropping and so forth in a trial where they were treating with only soluble carbon versus UAN32. And in this particular situation, the peas that were treated with soluble carbon and ended up with higher nitrogen content in the leaves, as you can see here, from ammonium as well as other elements such as phosphorus are actually higher or very comparable when not treated with UAN32. And in fact, the total nitrogen levels are actually higher in the treated block with only soluble carbon versus UAN32. So this is something that we see very often, is that it's not necessarily the nitrogen levels that we're looking at. It's the nitrogen to chloride ratios, or it's the nitrogen to carbon ratios within the plant that are limiting the uptake and so on and so forth. So now we're really starting to get into some deep philosophical questions about plants, how they manage nutrients, and what the implications are for us as agronomists. And this is a very true example from my own agronomic background that I can speak directly to, because this is a field that I have managed for a number of years, and this is a blackberry field where on the left-hand side you see the crop, on the right-hand side you see, you know, the crop in bloom, and this is actually a really good crop for us, and the grower does very well on these blackberries and so forth. However, this myth that plants require fertilization in order to balance nutritional levels does need some further examination, because when we test plants in nature for sap analysis, we see that there's a significant balance and uptake of nutrients without human intervention. And this is a really good example that I like to share, because blackberries like a lot of phosphorus, right? And we spend a lot of time in blackberry management out here in the Pacific Northwest managing phosphorus levels to get an adequate crop. And I felt this year in this crop, I did a pretty good job, you know, getting the blackberries up to 400, which is sort of the baseline level for phosphorus in organic. And this is an organic crop, by the way. On the right-hand side, you see a Himalayan blackberry, which is a wild blackberry species that grows in the Pacific Northwest, that was sampled from 15 feet away from the blackberry fields that we were managing. And you see the phosphorus numbers here are nearly double in the unfertilized blackberry. So despite my best efforts of managing phosphorus in this crop, the nature unfertilized a companion that was essentially a weed right across the fence line was outperforming my own best efforts. So shame on me for not understanding what the Himalayans were doing for nutrient management. Okay, carrying that one step further, this was a picture that was sent to me a few weeks ago by a corn grower in Iowa that decided that they didn't really have any money this year due to corn prices. So they weren't going to apply any nitrogen at all this year and see what happened. Well, so the main myth here that they're going after is plant needs optimal nitrogen to apply to develop properly. Well, the truth is that plants can thrive on low levels of nutrients delivered by microbes, and that this is actually how we see nature functioning. So you see two stalks of corn here, one on the left-hand side and one on the right-hand side. Both are actually reasonably hot, well-developed for this period in July, and this is about mid-July. And one is the non-GMO and the other is the GMO. And so the reality here is that both the GMO as well as the non-GMO were uptaking nutrients with only minerals and biology applied, no nitrogen, in fact. So in other words, what's happening out there is nitrogen-fixing microbes are converting the N2 gas through aeration in non-crusted soils. When that appropriate gas exchange is there, then they can translate that into NH4 that can be uptaken by plants. So in other words, we have a saying around here is that microbially digested carbon becomes nitrogen available for plants. Next myth that's significant for many of us out here, and this is another very very real life example from a grower in a strawberry field nearby. And the biggest myth then would be is that weeds are the biggest problem in my fields. Well, the truth is that weeds germinate under specific soil, mineral, and carbon and nitrogen conditions, and they often bioaccumulate soil excesses of minerals. Concurrently, weeds will be made weaker by adjustment of those conditions, and this is what we see over and over with our research. So you're looking at here some red root pigweed that had a 250-pound application of ag lime per acre in a strawberry field that was applied, and they weren't intending to deal with the red root pigweed through lime application. It just happened. And so what you're seeing here is the lime made the red root pigweed extremely sick and caused it to be parasited by a fungal pathogen. And so just as our crops can be parasited by fungal pathogens or insects, weeds can also be made that way if we adjust the soil conditions and adjust their nutrient uptake to undesirable pathways. And here's another really good example of that, where a grower in the Palouse sent us a dog fennel to be analyzed through sap analysis because they said, this is all over all of our fields. You know, can you tell us what it's uptaking and bioaccumulating? Because they had been to one of my previous talks. Well, in these fields in the Palouse, we see oftentimes very low levels of calcium uptake early in the crop. We also see extremely high levels of manganese in the crop at early season due to low pH. What you actually see when you analyze the dog fennel is it's actually hyperaccumulating sodium and manganese. So what are the two things that the growers are fighting in their fields? Excessive sodium and excessive manganese. And last but not least, the main myth that I hear out there, and I would say that this is probably the biggest myth that I probably hear in agronomy, as well as from farmers and from other professionals within the ag industry, is that it's not possible to do it sustainably, organically, or regeneratively. And in fact, through our research and the relationships that we've developed with growers or that we've seen growers doing on their own, we've seen regenerative or sustainable or organic crop production outperform or maintain yield on scale in all of these different crops in all of these different states. This list is not comprehensive. There may be many more that I did not include. And so if you're one of our growers that's not included on here, I apologize to you. This is basically off the top of my head for growers that we've seen that were able to outperform regeneratively or organically in on scale in ag systems against their conventional counterparts. The reality is growers across the USA and beyond are finding ways to implement those systems outside of the advice that's being given. And so it's up to us as agronomists to work with those new technologies and new techniques to implement those and stay current with our growing practices that our growers are after. And so here's, in short, a few examples of some of the results that our growers are achieving. When they balance nutrients, they implement biological building practices and soil health practices on scale. So this is an organic hop, completely outperformed the conventional version. These are organic cherries. We have probably half dozen growers that are outperforming in the Pacific Northwest, their conventional counterparts. And here's some pictures of regenerative citrus in certain situations in both Florida as well as California. We see regenerative and or organic citrus outperforming conventional. And so I really appreciate the time that you guys have all given myself and Al today. And with that, I think we can move to some questions.
Thank you both. Wonderful presentations. We've got a lot of questions coming in. We've got a lot of questions on soil health testing. So I think it would be great to hear from both of you what some of these tests show. Question on talking about stressors on the soil. Can you be more specific what these stressors are and what some of these soil functionality analyses might reveal?
Do you want to tackle that, David?
Oh, we lost your audio, David, for some reason.
Oh, is my mic on?
Yeah, it's on.
Yeah, there you go.
In soil health, typically the three biggest problems that we see are carbon and nitrogen imbalances. We see lack of diversity in terms of physical soil structure. So in other words, aggregate stability and so forth. So particle size and particle aggregation. And then lastly, we see imbalances of nutrients on any different shape and size.
And I would add to that, what we see many, many times is compromised microbial colonies. And we see that, you know, more attention needs to be given on how the functionality of the soil is working. So we want to be able to understand that. I like to look at genomics testing. We've seen that with sap analysis as well as how nutrients are moving and what is preventing those nutrients from moving. And that's usually a compromised biology in the soil. Jamie, you're muted.
Thank you. Al, this question's for you. With no-till, there has been evidence of more pee runoff in receiving waters because they apply on the surface. How do you think we can start promoting equipment change opportunities and education or alternatives like liquid applicators, industry marketing, and education? Have you started promoting the benefits of improving soil hydrologic function through improving soil health, aggregate stability? We are underestimating the power of watershed-wide soil health improvements to reduce dry period performance, water quality impacts, and water quantity flooding.
Yeah, so one of the most inefficient forms of fertility you can apply is dry forms of phosphorus, DAP or MAP, whatever these are. What we're beginning to learn now is that it's a limited resource anyway, and so we're beginning to kind of figure out ways to apply these products if there is deficiencies. Normally, I don't see much phosphorus deficiency when I look at the total nutrient level, but limited amounts of these in the form of manures, usually if you can get access to those, or liquid applications. Majority of the farmers I work with have basically stopped applying dry phosphate. And so we have systems in place now that can actually solubilize these nutrients, that particular nutrient, with microbial input. The biggest compromise the factor in soil health is the fungal colonies that have been compromised and depleted. So getting better, digestion and residue management, and to get those implemented. I'm all about putting those fungal colonies in with the inoculants and adding inoculants to help with this phosphorus movement is a major piece of what my job is with what I do every day. So phosphorus management is a big part of what biotech innovation is about.
And then, David, we had a couple of questions specific to your slides. One, I believe, was on blueberries. What was the source of soluble carbon?
I believe that was a combination of low micron scale biochar, humic acid, and a blend of other organic acids, such as citric, acetic, and so forth.
And then another question came in about the dog fennel. What resource do you use to find out what the weeds are a symptom of, such as dog fennel?
Yeah, again, I can't speak to what other folks are doing for that, but we use leaf sap analysis to identify the nutrient combinations in not just crops, but weeds or forestry, horticulture, et cetera.
Right. We've got a lot of comments coming in and less questions, so I'm going to drop the link to our discussion board. These would be really great for you guys to add in there. You can join our discussion board and sort of carry on some of these conversations, but we've still got, 5 minutes or so less, so we can try and get through some more of these questions. Let's see. Trying to filter out some of these comments. Sorry about that. Yeah, guys, if you can just ask a question in the question box, and then we'll reserve the comments for our discussion board. Are nutrient ratios variable depending on the soil, or are they standard ratios for some of the analysis?
Are you referring to nutrient ratios in plants or in soils?
I'm going to guess soils.
Yeah, that would be there would definitely be differences in desired nutrient ratios from one soil type to another. Absolutely.
Right.
Yeah. Is there a place or time for the use of the mold board plow?
Initial tillage, first time through. If you got some virgin land and you're wanting to begin to make that a farmland, then it's probably for the most part, it's an obsolete tool in most ag situations.
And then, interesting question came through. I wonder why our ag community keeps believing a lot of these common myths. Is this something that could be investigated? Are they hearing different messaging, and from who? A comment says, "I'm hopeful we can all get on the same page, messing and addressing this critical issue in the country."
I couldn't agree more. I'd like to address that one. So we find that there's a lot of bad opinions, people that are interjecting their opinions based on a lot of guessing. Honestly, that's the best way I can say it. And who's doing the guessing? Most of the time, it's people that are supposed to be in a position of authority for nutrient management. Honestly, I can't tell you the number of agronomists here locally in our bioregion that go around and make recommendations that we then have analysis that we do that runs 100% counter to that. And so I share your frustration about, you know, that it would be great to be on the same page. Personally, I feel that there was, we just haven't updated some of the agronomic models to include some of the recent findings and toolkits that are available, such as, you know, like Al was mentioning, you know, biological testing and aggregate stability testing and respiration and so forth. But also a lot of the things that we're doing in our lab around total digest analysis or leaf sap analysis. You know, we came at soil health from the plant's perspective. We looked into the plant to figure out what was happening in the soil and then sort of worked our way back through that process. And through that, we found there was significant gaps. You know, silicon is a huge one. Aluminum is another. Salt, sodium and chlorine right there. You know, if you just start looking at those and the problems that those elements are causing, not just to the crops themselves, but also to the microbes, right? So salt is a preservative, chlorine is an antimicrobial, as well as aluminum is an antimicrobial. There's a huge amount of connection between the biological degradation and the nutrient imbalance. And our opinion is that went off track through lack of understanding and some of the more recent advancements that, you know, silicon hasn't been given its fair shake, that sort of thing. Carbon.
I couldn't agree more. I couldn't agree more, David. That's exactly right. I mean, the overuse of potassium chloride in traditional farming has just absolutely devastated some of our farm soils. So the misconception out there is that the second myth that I talked about is fertility grows plants is not true. That plants actually are living off of digested nutrients.
Yeah, and we come to that same conclusion through the plant analysis, right? So, like the slide that I showed there about the blackberries, where the blackberries were uptaking higher levels of nutrition than the fertilized ones 10 feet away. Right. That's not an isolated case. We've analyzed hundreds of plants in nature, and they're very well found to be operating just fine. And certain cases, much higher levels of nutrition than the crops that we fertilize. So there's underlying mechanisms at play within nature that we're not privy to at the moment. And it would be helpful if we, as an industry, could dig into that a little further.
Yes.
Excellent. Thank you. Well, we have one more question we can probably get to, and then otherwise you guys can join our discussion boards. Please put a lot of your great comments in there and you can connect with one another. Last question is, if the weeds are showing high, low nutrients, but the farms are not making those applications, i.e. nutrients in the soil, how have you addressed that? Would there not be other weeds that would move in for the newly created conditions?
Yeah, that's a really good question. And oftentimes it's a predisposition or a release of soil nutrients due to pH adjustment. So in the dog fennel example, the soil in that bioregion has been driven down through excessive applications of acidic fertilizer over the course of the last 20, 30 years. So there's really low pH that's releasing the manganese that crop or that weed was uptaking. But say you then go and start to apply, you know, whatever, carbon and calcium or something of that nature. Yes, the weed profile would change and the new weeds theoretically would show up. However, what we've seen is as soils get healthier, the weeds become less competitive with the main season crop, as well as those weeds become less persistent, and you transition from perennial weeds to annual weeds.
Excellent. Thank you. There's been some questions for some resources. So Al shared some resources with me. Otherwise, feel free to join that discussion board, and we'll continue putting resources in there. And then if any of the attendees have things to share, you're welcome to get engaged.